Hello and welcome to episode this one of the Positive Thinking and Meaning of Life podcast. My name remains Marcus Freestone. I thought that I had used my entire collection of notes from courses and writing on these and related subjects in the book. So you can imagine my delight when I was sorting through my flat recently and found a whole file full of material that I'd completely forgotten about, answers to questions and surveys and short essays that I wrote when I was on some courses. And the first few things I'm going to read are from a positive psychology course that I did a few years ago. So I'm just going to crack on and read all this because it was a very well-designed course and I think it's all useful stuff and related to the themes of this podcast. So buckle up tight, draw the curtains, photograph the armchair, and enjoy yourself. Two short questions to start with. It said, what do you understand by the terms mental health and happiness? For mental health, I wrote, stable emotions, rational judgments, sound decision-making, and considered actions. For happiness, I wrote lack of stress and fear, balance and contentment within one's own mind, clear, achievable short-term goals, living in the moment rather than being haunted by the past or worrying about the future. I know that those last things are not always easy to do, and I myself still struggle with them, but at least if you know what you should be doing, then you can at least attempt it and you will get it right some of the time. This section is about abnormality and normality. The question is, what does it mean to say that someone is abnormal or that they exhibit abnormal behaviour, thinking or feeling? And my response was, the problem is that we judge people's thinking and feeling by their external behaviour, because that is the only method of assessment available. But there is not necessarily a direct correlation between inward state and outward appearance. It is therefore a subjective value judgment as to whether someone is abnormal, and people have very different thresholds as to what behaviour they consider abnormal. And I'm sure I mentioned it in the free edition of the book, how I have been, in my opinion, wrongly judged in the past by people as being abnormal when I was empirically and very obviously reacting normally to a bad situation. But if the other people haven't been in that kind of bad situation, then they think your behaviour is abnormal because they don't know that inside your head you are still making rational decisions. It's just that you're in a bad place and it seems impossible to get out of. And the next question says, who decides who the abnormals are and how should the normals react to them? And I said, ultimately, abnormality is a social convention which changes over time. 300 years ago, belief in witchcraft was a social norm. Now it's verging on mental illness. Therefore, the deciders of normality are the lawmakers and opinion formers of the day in any particular society, and consequently there are huge worldwide discrepancies in what is considered normal and abnormal. A scientific definition could be a significant deviation from social norms, but of course these norms and what constitutes a significant deviation from them are entirely subjective and ephemeral. It also depends on how you define the terms, e.g. someone can be abnormally gifted or abnormally intelligent, whereas being of normal intelligence could be taken as meaning average and dull and an insult. Normal usually means the same as everyone else, and that is not always, in my opinion, a positive quality. I've been judged abnormal on many occasions, and now prefer to assess people empirically on an individual basis. And then I continued, to say that someone is abnormal means that they are exhibiting traits and or a physical appearance that do not conform to that which society regards as normal. If they exhibit abnormal behaviour, thinking or feeling in a non-criminal context, they will find themselves marginalised and often isolated by that same society. As to who decides who the abnormals are, in a media-driven world, society's idea of normality is reinforced by the media. A recent example would be Chris Jeffries, the landlord to murdered architect Joe Yates, who was initially taken in for questioning by the police. His eccentric appearance and single status was a boon to the press coverage, producing such scaremongering headlines as "The Strange Life of Murdered Joe's Landlord." It was soon proved that he had committed no more than the arch crime of not fitting into the normality that society and the media demand, and was completely innocent of any part in the crime. And this next question says, the prevention and management of conditions like anxiety and depression in the UK is only partially successful. And bloody hell, do I have personal experience of that. If you were in government, what provisions would you introduce to improve the situation? And I wrote, I would put the emphasis on empowering patients to improve their own lives and state of mind rather than treating them as having a clinical condition. I would direct GPs to only use medication as an absolute last resort and to favour cognitive behavioural therapy or counselling instead. Although I recently was feeling bad and went to my GP a couple of months ago and I said, look, I'm really struggling with depression and I've been thinking about suicide. Is there any counselling or therapy I can have? And he said, we do have a counsellor here at the surgery, but if I were you, I wouldn't bother booking an appointment because there's a 3 month plus waiting list and it's limited to 6 sessions. Now, that's not his fault. That's down to government and local authority funding of the NHS. But that's the situation in my area. I continued, I would encourage mental health patients to study psychology and gain insights into their own problems rather than being made to feel marginalised and that there is something wrong with them. I would put more funding into non-clinical support groups and also informing the public about the realities of mental health to attempt to combat the prejudice and stigma. And bearing in mind my recent experiences and the experiences of a friend of mine, my friend who has bipolar, who has recently got the shit end of the stick with regarding treatment when she was in crisis, I believe in those words even more than I did when I wrote that 3 years ago. This question says, please read the Positive Psychology Manifesto produced in 2000. Do you think that the approach that it describes is feasible? Can it work? If so, who will have to do what to make it work? Now, as I'm recording this, I can't actually find that copy of that manifesto, but before I upload this episode, I will find it and I will put a link to it so that you know what this question refers to. Although maybe you don't actually need to know that particular manifesto, but if I can find it, I will put a link up to it. And my reply was, in the institutional sense, I don't think this manifesto can work. If you look at the manner in which global institutions function, it is clear that the larger any group of decision makers becomes, the more chaotic and difficult becomes the taking and implementing of any decision, even something as trivial as the size and shape of bananas. Listeners outside the UK or outside of Europe may not get that reference. That was quite a big news story a few years ago that it was something to do with the EU had this massive expensive committee with dozens of people who decided that they needed to pass a regulation that bananas had to be a certain level of curvature or it was illegal to sell them. I have no particular views one way or another as to whether the UK should be in Europe or not. We're kind of half and half at the moment. And as I recalled this, 3 days ago, Scotland voted by 55% to 45% to not become independent. And I believe they had a previous vote in 1979, which also voted no. So that's probably the end of that. And we've been promised a referendum on whether to stay in or leave Europe after the next election. And personally, I couldn't really give a toss about either issue. But that was that was the banana reference. And there, that was just one example. There are lots of stupid regulations around food. Actually, seriously, there's a lot of problems to do with them putting too conservative a sell-by date on them. So that, you know, I think we throw away more food in the West than it would take to feed the whole of the developing world. Anyway, back to, after that diversion, back to the positive psychology. The sad truth is that political regimes talk about the good of the people or individual happiness, but are more concerned with keeping people docile and obedient. An electorate of happy, well-balanced people wouldn't put up with most political acts. Also, regimes in China, Iran, America, and UK have very different ideas about common values, and one regime's happiness is another's political oppression or secular heresy. Therefore, I think this manifesto can only ever be implemented among small groups or individuals. It is ultimately up to each person how they wish to live their life. The only role institutions can play is to empower people with the freedom and information to make and enact those choices for themselves. Having said that, a change in focus from clinical cure of disease to positive reinforcement can only be a good thing. But especially now, who's going to pay for it? For this to work globally, it would need politicians and media institutions to move towards a positive psychology. And sadly, I can't see that ever happening. This next section is about achieving mental health. And it says, two major research projects have identified three factors, autonomy, competence, and relatedness, either as needs that we seek to satisfy to achieve mental health, or as symptoms of mental illness itself. How important do you think these three factors are to you personally? Are there any other equally important features of mental health that the research has so far missed? And I responded thusly. I think all three factors are very important. I gave autonomy 100 out of 100 because I only feel that I'm in charge of my own life now that I've extricated myself from all parental influence or comment. Living on my own is also very important to me as it allows me to pursue my own agenda and timetable without having to compromise. Competence is vital because it's pointless having ambitions without the ability to achieve them. Feeling that you lack the requisite competences leads to low self-esteem and even despair and helplessness. We all need human contact, but I think an over-reliance on relatedness can be negative. I've known people who simply disintegrate when confronted with their own company for even a few minutes because they lacked the inner resources to spend even the briefest time alone. I think you need to be equally happy with solitude and company to be mentally healthy, because life surely involves both. The main thing missing, I think, is the setting of regular, short-term, achievable goals. A sense of constantly achieving something, however small, is vital for a sense of purpose and to avoid stagnation. If you are constantly working but have no accompanying sense of achievement or forward momentum, then that can breed futility and despair. Again, I can't find the accompanying list of these six virtues that are mentioned, but I were asked to pick two, and I mention what they are, so hopefully this will make sense. Seligman claims that gratifications cannot be obtained without developing personal strengths and virtues. Do you think that this is true, or is it an attempt to smuggle some old philosophical ideas into modern psychology? Whatever you personally believe, look through the list of virtues and say which two of them you feel that you have developed most strongly in your own life. How does developing these virtues, or failing to develop them, make you feel about yourself? And I responded, virtues are a nebulous concept. I would certainly say that there have been plenty of successful people who were not especially virtuous, however you define the term. Certainly, you need a strong character to get very much out of life. Weak people will always be exploited, alienated, and disempowered. I don't see any clear dividing line between psychology and philosophy. For me, they are merely two differing approaches to the same subject, human thought, behaviour, and motivation. Picking two of the six virtues is difficult because I identify with some of the definitions, but not really with any of the overarching categories. For example, I would say I have cognitive strengths that entail the acquisition and use of knowledge, and definitely possess creativity, curiosity, etc. But wisdom and knowledge is not a virtue I would ascribe to myself because I have a very high definition of what that would entail, and I know that I'm nowhere near it yet. Based on the definitions here, I would say courage is the other one I have most of, but again, while I feel that I fulfil all the definitions on the right, I certainly wouldn't call myself a courageous person, because I think I've led a life thus far which has been highly lacking in what I would define as courage. In other words, reading this now, I think I possess a strong sense of self and the courage to do things, but I often lack the energy or ability or whatever to actually put it into practice. I think that's what I meant. This was nearly 4 years ago I wrote this. And I concluded, overall, I find these categories interesting, and I've never thought about my life in this way. I'm pleasantly surprised to discover that I possess a lot more of these facets than I would expect, and that I'm currently acquiring new ones all the time, because my life is on a huge upward trajectory at the moment. So, that's a nice positive way to end on, which is good for a course in positive psychology, and indeed this podcast. And this says, happiness, personality, and health. Describing personality. How would you describe your own personality in three short paragraphs? Consider your habits and attitudes, your strengths and weaknesses, your attractive and unattractive features. And I'm reading this for the first time since I wrote it, so I don't know, and it'll be interesting to see whether I still agree with this or not. Anyway, here goes. My habit is to be creative and solitary, but I'm now forging new relationships and being a lot more outgoing. I feel that intellectual and creative pursuits are the only worthwhile ones, and that most things most people choose to concern themselves with are a waste of time, though I acknowledge that this is my subjective opinion. I've grown up with very negative habits and attitudes, but in recent years have challenged and overcome many of them. My strengths are my intellectual perspicacity, my quick-witted imagination and sense of humour, my individual approach to music and writing, my conversational skills and passionate interest in a knowledge of several varied subjects, my stubbornness / reluctance to give up on life. Well, that's kind of made me pause there, because I've had many ideas of giving up on life and taking an overdose or whatever in the last few months, and yet I'm still here and I'm still in good health. So clearly that stubbornness is still there. So good for stubbornness in that context. I continued, my weaknesses are appalling concentration. That's ironic. My weaknesses are appalling concentration and tendency to daydream and go off on metaphysical tangents. An almost autistic inability to remember faces, names, physical locations, sets of instructions or directions, etc. A tendency towards cynicism and brutal sarcasm. An over-analytical approach towards things which should be instinctive. A feeling of non-entitlement which prevents me achieving many things within my abilities. My most attractive feature is my ability to improvise humour in any situation and entertain any group of people for as long as I want. My most unattractive feature is my tendency to ignore other people and remain insular and locked into my own thoughts. I'm currently working very hard to eradicate this trait. Wow, that's as the Americans would say, that's brought up a lot of issues for me reading that again. I definitely agree with most of it. I wrote that and it was a particularly good time in my life. And I'm glad that only a couple of days after probably the most stressful week of my life, I'm actually feeling like this again. So I think I have this stubbornness and reluctance to give up on life. I think I would add to my strength now, I think I would add resilience. I'm far better now than I was, even I think a couple of years ago, at overcoming problems and emotional and physical pain and mental pain as well. So, way hey, good for me. Okay, so I will conclude this episode with things that I wrote on a fear-busting course. It just says, my perfect life, ... I would not have asthma, chronic pain, insomnia, or depression. I would never smoke again and weigh 12 and a half stone. I would live in a quiet, leafy suburb on my own in a house with two cats and a snooker table. I would have a full recording studio and earn a living from making my own music. I would form an improvisational jazz band and play live all over Britain, but not abroad as I don't fly. That's the negativity coming in there. I would also run evenings of semi-improvised classical / electronic music with a rotating smorgasbord of musicians. I would publish novels, non-fiction and poetry, but not be obliged to tread the vacuous publicity junket circuit. I would also tour my stand-up comedy show and do live poetry readings. At the Edinburgh Festival, I would do all these types of shows. I would do poetry and story readings at Hay on Wye and other literary festivals. I would be able to cycle again. I would buy a moped and explore the countryside. I would go away for walking weekends in Cornwall, Yorkshire, etc. I would get my sitcom on the TV and be allowed to direct and star in it, as well as having my own sketch show on the radio with my friend Brian. I would be more outgoing, meet new people and have relationships with women that are free of emotional blackmail, stress and hassle. I would cease to be a misanthrope and cease to resent people for having more opportunities than me. I would cease to resent my parents and be haunted and dragged down by my past. I would free my mind from all irrelevancies and not think about situations while I'm not actually in them at the present moment. I would stop rehearsing conversations days in advance and stop wasting so much time going over and over past mistakes and fantasizing about how I should have acted. I will every day experience new things, read new books and watch new DVDs, rather than settling for the safe retreat of experiencing the same things over and over again. I would not get angry at things I hear on the news or idiots I see in the street. Well, without being tedious and going into specific examples, I would say that in the 4 years since I wrote that, I have achieved probably about 40 to 50% of it. So I'm definitely not a misanthrope anymore. I did go for a lovely walking holiday in the Lake District for my 40th birthday. I've published 10 books and currently about 25 albums. Yes, and I've improved my attitude to a lot of these things to a really big degree. So, yeah, well done me. And that would be a good exercise for anyone listening to do. As indeed, I think, with this, although this is a bit kind of therapy-y for me, although the person who took this course was a therapist, so that would explain it. So this is the final bit for this episode. It says, what makes you special? And I say, my imagination and creativity. I spent a long time working out who I am and reinforcing my individuality rather than following along with all the other sheep. I am not afraid to speak my mind and stand by opinions even when I'm in a minority of one. And then it says, okay, be more specific, break it down. And I say, I've developed my own synthesis of psychology, philosophy and science and have the confidence to disagree with some great minds if what they say doesn't apply to me. This has allowed me the freedom to be unique in my music, writing and comedy and not try to emulate the work of others. I value my work for the personal achievement of creating it rather than requiring any validation from others. Well, you know, that's not entirely true. I am still struggling to earn a living from all this work that I do. And yes, it's nice to get validation. Although I do value the creative process very highly. And I mainly do the things I do because I love the process of doing them rather than for the end product. But as I spend most of my time doing it, it would be nice to earn a living at it. But certainly, the very nice reviews that I've had for the free book have been, I was going to say a great comfort, that's the wrong word, but they have meant a lot to me. And then finally, it says, how could it be better? And I say, I could vastly improve my levels of concentration and application and spend my time far more profitably. I am still frequently distracted by irrelevancies, and in some ways I still let other people get to me when their opinions and lives are absolutely nothing to do with me. I would say that although I still have problems concentrating, that all other than that, all that last bit, I have vastly improved. The last couple of years have seen a huge progression in the amount of work that I have done, and it's a cumulative effect. 3 years ago, I did a lot more work than the previous year, and then the next year, and then the next year, and now this year. I have just achieved so much with expanding my website and all the new music I've made and starting two podcasts and all the just massive amount of work this year, and I'm really proud of it. And although I still lack concentration, and I am still frequently distracted by irrelevancies, but I've learned that when I am working, I think I can get more done despite the problems with concentration and distraction. So it's not that those problems have gone away, but I think I'm dealing with them better. And that's allowed me to get a lot more work done in probably the same amount of time. So I am using my time more profitably. So big tick there. When I say I still let other people get to me when their opinions and lives are absolutely nothing to do with me, that was 4 years ago. I think I can honestly say that that almost never happens now. I've become a lot stronger in terms of self-belief and in ignoring or rejecting, or maybe even not noticing what other people think of me. So I think that's a good note on which to end this edition of Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life. Bye-bye, listeners, and join me for the next episode. And please go to the website, go to marcusfreestone.com, listen to my comedy podcast, download the free music, 3 free ebooks, and I'm thinking about putting a PayPal donation button on this site, but I kind of feel a bit ambivalent about it, as if I'm kind of trying to guilt trip listeners into giving me money, and I think podcasts should be free, so maybe I won't do that, but instead at the end of every episode I'll say what I'm going to say now, which is that if you like this podcast and you get a lot out of it, then please help me out by posting about it on Facebook or wherever you go to post things. There's like and share buttons on all my web pages. And, you know, if you like some of my free music, then my albums, there's 20 of at the moment, are available on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, Spotify. You can go on Spotify and you can listen to the albums, and then if you like it, it's about $6 or $7 for an album, and they're all about 50 to 60 minutes, and there's metal, jazz, blues, rock, ambient, electronica, something for everyone. So yeah, if you enjoy this free podcast, it'd be really great if you could chuck me a few quid, stroke dollars, stroke yen, stroke insert currency of your country. I'm never going to get sort of sponsors or advertising for this, so I hope that bit's not too annoying. But as I say, I really would love to earn a living at this. So if you want to encourage me to continue and make more of these podcasts, all my books now available digitally for 99 cents. There's 3 or 4 novels and a few shorter books, including the extended version of Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life and 101 Ways to Happiness, which is a fun, silly little book. And there's also My Mate's Got a UFO in His Shed, which is an entertaining little book about all the weird people I've met in my life, and also me admitting to some of my own inner and outer weirdness. So that's the end of the propaganda. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Bye!